Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. As a special holiday treat, we're back with a bonus episode. You thought your Christmas was dramatic? That's nothing compared to what George Washington and the Continental Army faced crossing the Delaware River on Christmas Day in 1776. To help us unpack their journey, we're joined by...
My name is Michael Plum. I'm the Vice President for Education and Engagement at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
We signed off last season with the Declaration of Independence setting the summer of 76 ablaze and moving past the point of no return. Now we drop back into the story in December, and let's just say the shine has worn off. The Continental Army hasn't stopped fighting for a single heartbeat in the months in between, and it's going about as well as you'd expect for an underfed, underpaid, and soon-to-be half-frozen collection of revolutionaries trying to take on the British Empire.
It's not a great fall for George Washington and the Continental Army. It's kind of a string of really bad defeats. So early on, going back to like August, so the month after the Declaration, he loses the Battle of Brooklyn. That's followed by losing the Battle of Harlem Heights in September after managing to get his force from Long Island back to Manhattan. So give him some props. But again, loses that battle at Harlem Heights. In fact, there's a great letter that Washington writes. Throughout his time fighting, Washington writes, "In short, such is my situation that if I were to wish the bitterest curse to an enemy on this side of the grave, I should put him in my stead with my feelings. And yet I do not know what plan of conduct to pursue." So Washington he's pretty angsty. He knows that things are not going well.
And Washington isn't the only one who can feel the wheels coming off. In a December 1776 letter held here in the VMHC's collection, Captain Griffith writes about Washington's frantic troop movements, the fact that no one's been paid in 4 months, and how desperate the men are for even a day of leave. And beneath all of that, he's begging for news from home, missing his dearest Hannah, wishing her letters came faster than the war. By mid-December, morale was in the basement. The Continental Army is in retreat, the Continental Congress has bolted from Philadelphia, and Charles Lee, one of the highest-ranking officers of the Continental Army, has been taken by the British. And, as if the chaos needed one last flourish, winter slams the door behind them.
Even worse, probably, than morale is the actual state of the army. So Washington has an army on paper, but the actual army that's present and fit for duty is pretty different. And he does constantly write to Congress. Some of the best letters describing this period come from Washington writing to John Hancock and trying to kind of feel out his role, what he can do, what needs sort of congressional oversight to provide. And it's a lot that he's trying to fit together. I mean, ultimately, he's got somewhere around 6,000 troops, give or take, that are kind of fit and present for duty by the time we get closer to Trenton. There are other units available, and others are trying to kind of make their way to him. But he also is facing the reality that a lot of those units, that even if they are there and present in the moment, have enlistments that expire in a matter of days, right at the end of December 1776, a large portion of that army is set to just get up and walk away because their enlistment terms have finished.
Washington knows he has to move fast, faster than the cold, faster than the British, faster than his own army unraveling thread by thread. Right now, the Delaware River is the only real barrier between the British forces dug in across New Jersey and Washington's exhausted, ice-bitten troops clinging to Pennsylvania. But that line of defense is temporary at best. Just like those enlistments about to expire, the river is a ticking clock. Washington can see the future too clearly. Once the Delaware freezes, it stops being protection and starts being a bridge. A frozen highway the British can stroll across with ease. And if that happens, Philadelphia, the beating symbolic heart of this brand new American experiment, could fall as the ink on the Declaration is barely dry. Washington isn't just fighting winter. He's fighting against what some are starting to worry is inevitable. The loss of the American experiment before it even has a chance to try to form something greater than what came before.
He starts to think about a plan by which he can use the troops at his disposal to achieve a win somewhere, right? And Trenton becomes a logical spot in many ways because it's sort of the most exposed of these British garrisons. It's kind of the one that's furthest west from the other British garrisons that could potentially support it. That doesn't mean that it's a weak spot. I mean, there's something like 1,400 soldiers there, but it is something that with the size of the army he had at his disposal, envisioned this plan to cross the river and make this attack. And he thinks that he's going to do this with what he thinks is a pretty brilliant plan. He's going to have three columns that cross the river at various points. He would be in command of one of those columns crossing upriver from Trenton. Another column was envisioned to cross below Trenton and actually engage and prevent some of those other British reinforcements from making their way there. And another unit that would cross really right at Trenton to protect and guard a bridge that leads out of town so that the Hessians that are the soldiers that are there in Trenton can't escape. All that requires a ton of logistics, a lot of planning, a lot of things necessary to go right. And again, kind of on par with the experience in prior months, really not much goes to plan and not much goes right for him. But it's a really good plan. And again, the end goal is defeating, capturing this post at Trenton in a relatively kind of minor, small scale engagement, but one that's going to have really important consequences for morale, for ultimately the outlook of the upcoming campaign season.
And so on Christmas night, 1776, while lanterns flickered in homes across the colonies, Washington begins his bold and dangerous plan. A river crossing in winter would test any army. This one is held together by resolve and frostbitten fingers. As the storm rises, snow turns to sleet, sleet turns to stinging ice, and the timing unravels. Of the forces meant to cross, only Washington's column makes it to the other side, and they do so hours behind schedule, slipping onto the New Jersey shore sometime around 3 or 4 in the morning. The men are wet, exhausted, and shaking from the cold. Yet they shoulder their muskets and march another 9 or 10 miles through the dark toward Trenton, New Jersey. Washington pauses, just for a moment, to consider turning back. But he knows the stakes. What happens next will not just shift momentum. It will breathe life back into a revolution that is, at this moment, very near its breaking point. With roughly 2,400 men, he presses on towards the Hessian troops stationed at Trenton, these professional soldiers hired to fight for the British Empire.
The Hessians get a lot of talk because that's who is primarily garrisoning the town of Trenton. There's one small, I think, force of British light dragoons, but primarily it is the Hessian soldiers. And Hessians are kind of a buzzword when it comes to the revolution. The term mercenary comes up a lot. People are talking about the Hessians as mercenary soldiers. But today we think of a mercenary as sort of a soldier of fortune, someone who is being paid personally to fight in a cause that's not their own. But these units are different. They're standing forces from German principalities. And the British, with their ties to the House of Hanover, are actually going to pay these German principalities for use of their troops. And so those troops come across. They are a major part of the British war effort in North America throughout the war. They do tend to serve sometimes sort of on their own in detached commands, like the one we have at Trenton. They didn't always get along well with the other British soldiers. So sometimes you see them kind of taking possession of a garrison like this on their own. They're under the command of a Colonel Johann Rahl, and Rahl is a career officer, very experienced, has spent like his entire adult life fighting battles all across Europe. He doesn't necessarily get along well with everyone in the British Army, but is definitely well-respected and certainly experienced. The thing that we do know about Rahl, though, is that he does have some contempt for the Continental troops. He's warned about impending attacks. His soldiers have been fending off a fairly constant series of attacks and skirmishes from local militia units. And he's encouraged to fortify the town and take these threats seriously. But in the end, he does not. Now, there is a common sort of myth about Rahl and the Hessians in general, because it's Christmas, that they were drunk or had been enjoying themselves too much that day. By all accounts, that's really probably not the case. Rahl does have a little bit of a reputation for enjoying drink quite a bit, but by and large, I mean, it's not really something that comes up about the soldiers themselves being not prepared, but preparations were lacking in general in regards to what was sort of a known potential attack by Washington.
When Washington's ragged, exhausted men finally reach Trenton, the fight that follows is swift, almost shockingly so. He doesn't just bring men, he also brings the weight of artillery, carefully positioned under the keen eye of Henry Knox, firing down the streets and cutting off the Hessians as they pour out of buildings, blinking in the cold dawn. In just a few hours, the battle is over, leaving the quiet streets of Trenton to tell the story of a winter night that changed everything.
Something like 900 soldiers eventually surrender as part of that garrison. So pretty remarkable. Some were able to escape, but it was a really large force for Washington to be able to capture with losses that were on his side that were almost non-existent.
We usually think of Washington crossing the Delaware as a single iconic moment. But in reality, after the victory at Trenton, the Continental Army crosses that icy river again and again, ferrying prisoners and captured equipment back into Pennsylvania, moving men and material farther inland. Yet the true gift of this first Battle of Trenton isn't captured in weapons or maps or men. It's in the surge of morale, the spark of hope Washington and the Continental Congress had been waiting for, a Christmas present born of cold, courage, and sheer audacity.
Definitely a big, big morale boost. And Washington, you know, in his general orders and his writings after the battle, really directly appeal to that success to say, hey, we have shown that we can do these things. Please stick around a little while longer. That's all well and good. He's also offering cash as part of reenlistment bounties to stay on. The arms and equipment that are captured in Washington's general orders after the battle, he writes that they're going to be assessed, and that value of that captured equipment would then be paid out amongst the officers and some of the soldiers who participated in the attack. So that helps. It does embolden him, though, to eventually recross the Delaware with the forces that he has at hand. And by early January of 1777, that's roughly 3,000 soldiers. So he's going to recross the Delaware, goes back to Trenton, and prepares for a British counterattack that they knew was likely to come from larger forces that were gathering nearby in Princeton, New Jersey. So that battle happens. There's a second Battle of Trenton early in January 1777. Washington is able to sort of successfully defend a portion of the town on the other side of Assunpink Creek. Washington fights this defensive battle there. And while that battle is kind of reaching its conclusion, does a typical Washington thing and establishes a bit of a ruse and is able to move most of his army away to Princeton, where that larger attacking force had come from. He moves to Princeton, attacks the remaining forces that are there. And again, a successful battle for Washington. And after that, is able to keep moving to Morristown, New Jersey, where finally he goes into sort of a more permanent winter quarters. So it's a big turning point for Washington and the Continental Army. While the battles, again, are relatively small in nature, they do show that the Continental Army can, in whatever way they need to, match the British in terms of military might. And coming off of, just a string of defeats in that New York campaign was really important.
Let's take a moment to linger on how this crossing has entered the American imagination. The Christmas Night Crossing, a story frozen in time, becomes almost mythic, a gift to the patriot cause that would echo for generations. Emanuel Lutz, in 1851, painted his iconic canvas, Washington, larger than life, standing at the bow, resolute. But step closer, it wasn't just one man on that icy river. There were rowers, men straining against current and chunks of ice, officers shouting orders through the dark, artillery teams moving guns and ammunition with painstaking care. These are the hands, the bodies, the sweat, and the courage that carried the day. The silent, essential figures of history.
Yeah, it always gets that moniker, but definitely it was a larger effort. The Army at that point is kind of a who's who of some of these bigger names we hear later on in the war. So you have, of course, an Alexander Hamilton there, Henry Knox, Nathaniel Greene. Keeping it to Virginia, we've got James Monroe, so future president, participating in the crossing and in the subsequent battle where he is wounded. But yeah, it is a really interesting moment for the Continental Army because it is emblematic of the unique nature of that force. Washington gives orders to start assembling boats and things that'll be really important for the crossing. But who's going to be doing all of this work? Who is experienced enough to know how to operate these boats and really confidently get this army across in the midst of terrible weather, you know, an ice-choked river, all these things? Well, enters John Glover of Marblehead, Massachusetts. And John Glover is in command of the 14th Regiment of the Continental Line. And that was an integrated unit. So there were black and white soldiers fighting together in that unit. And also just happens to be filled with experienced watermen from the Massachusetts area who were really vital to kind of manning those boats and leading those troops across the Delaware River. So yeah, it is a who's who in many ways, but there are certainly some others who don't often get the credit that they're deserving of making this a successful crossing.
And now, the question that really matters. Did the men get any Christmas presents? Kind of, but not in the sense of wrapped packages or sugar plums.
They got some rum. Yeah, in the general orders that are issued on the 27th, I'm pretty sure Washington does say, he tells them about the assessment of the value of the stuff that was captured and that there might be a little bit of coin coming their way from that. But then also, yeah, go on and get some rum to warm up and celebrate the victory.
From all of us here at the VMHC, we're sending you a little warmth. And if you're so inclined, a splash of rum this holiday season. Merry Christmas, and may your days be full of stories worth telling. Thanks so much to Michael Plum for sharing his insights on today's episode. And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us for this bonus episode of Revolution Revisited.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Riley Reynolds, Nicole Martorana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.